Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Siegel, Judge Riley, the Honorable Kevin Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Court of Appeals for this July 27 virtual oral calendar today. The next case on our calendar is Berg v. Berg. Apologies to counsel for some technical difficulties causing a bit of a delay in commencing, but these things, I guess, are expected with technology. So bearing that in mind, as you commence your argument, please recognize that occasionally we might have other tech or see a member of the panel or your opposing counsel. Just flag us and we'll pause the proceedings to make sure we can get everybody on the same technological page. Even though we can see you now and we have everyone's names on the screen, we are recording the proceedings only by audio, not by video. So please keep in mind our regular procedure, which is for each counsel to state your name as you commence each leg of your argument for the benefit of our audio recording that we make available to the public online. Counsel, each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you choose to use that time for rebuttal. And with that, whenever you are ready to proceed, counsel for the appellant, you may do so.
May it please the court, good morning. This is Bruce Goldstein representing the appellant. First question might be why it is that I'm involved in this case, arguing at such a late date. And I would tell you all that there's at least two things that you can't buy online at Amazon these days. One would be an old friend, and Mr. Berg, who's behind me, is indeed an old friend. And when he had a fee dispute with his prior counsel and was in need of legal help, he came to me and I agreed to help him. The other thing that you can't get online at Amazon, Your Honors, is justice. And I would tell you that in the 41 years of practice that I've now had, I've never seen such a case involving such an injustice. And Mr. Berg has certainly not gotten justice from the Dakota County District Court. And we are here before you today trying to seek the justice that he isn't so in need of. I would begin by focusing on the antenuptial agreement, which is really one of the main subjects of this appeal. And I think it's important that we put the antenuptial agreement in context.
I'm gonna interrupt you for a second because it seems like the first issue is really what's properly before this court on this appeal. So can you address that issue first?
I'd be happy to, Your Honor. Thank you for that question. And it's been pretty well briefed below when Mr. Knack was still representing the appellant. But I would, one of the supplemental authorities that I cited in the supplement to the case is the Alpha case. And the Alpha case, I think, is important because the Supreme Court tells us in no uncertain terms that when there's a written agreement that is clear and unambiguous, like the antenuptial agreement here, that the court cannot modify an agreement like that. And also that case stands for the proposition that the interpretation of a contract, especially an antenuptial agreement, is a question of law. The Court of Appeals hears those questions of law de novo, and the Court of Appeals, or the Supreme Court as the case may be, does not have to give deference to the trial court's conclusions and really conducts a de novo review. So the antenuptial agreement is a key element of this case. It is properly before the court. It was included in the statement of the case. It was included in all of the arguments that were made down below. And there's zero reason why this court should not be focusing on that. Does that answer your question, Judge?
Yeah, so you, the argument that the district court deviated from the antenuptial agreements be properly forth. Anything else, just real quickly, and I know you've got a lot of territory to cover, so I don't want
to take up
too much time. Yeah, yeah.
And again, I would, if there's a specific question on that process, I would answer it. But given the timing, it's been well briefed below, and I believe that the antenuptial agreement, the reason for the default hearing and the problems with the default hearing, which are all issues of due process, are all properly before the court. And again, when you look at that prenuptial agreement, that antenuptial agreement, again, we're going back to August of 1998. It's important for the court, I think, to recognize who these folks were that entered into it. These were both mature adults. They were both 46 years old. They were both married before. They were both divorced before. They both had two daughters, and they wanted to make sure that they try to control their destiny and properly write an exit strategy for themselves if this marriage did not work out. And they clearly and they unambiguously drafted that exit strategy. As the court knows, antenuptial agreements are favored in the state of Minnesota. We have an enabling statute in 519.11. We have the precedent-setting case of Pollock Halverson versus McGuire back in 1998. And I find it sort of amazing that that parties to an antenuptial agreement are able to do two things. They're able to plan their vows as they're getting married, hoping that everything works out, and they're able to plan their exit strategy if things...
Mr. Goldstein, again, I'm sorry for continuing to interrupt here, but moving into the ways in which you your client believes that the district court deviated from the terms of the antenuptial agreement. I mean, I understand that one is accelerating the monthly $13,500 payments. I mean, that's pretty clear.
Right.
And then beyond that, it really is not very clear to me from the briefing what the other claims are with respect to how the district court deviated. Yeah. So if you could focus in on that for a couple minutes, that would be very helpful.
It was deviated so much that it frankly makes my head spin. But first, I think you have to look at Section 13B of the antenuptial agreement, which clearly and unambiguously states that the provisions of this agreement shall not be subject to subsequent modification by any court. So the intent of the parties was they made a deal that was supposed to be the deal. If you look at the antenuptial agreement, in particular the exhibits, you'll see that Mrs. Berg had one property listed. Mr. Berg had approximately 15 properties listed. The intent of the parties was to preserve the status quo there should things not work out. The appointment of the receiver by the judge, which was certainly not contemplated by the antenuptial agreement, the acceleration of the amount due, which is a huge problem.
So how did the appointment of the receiver violate the antenuptial agreement? I mean, are you questioning the authority of the district court? Let's just assume for the sake of argument that the appointment of a receiver, aside from the, let's say there was no antenuptial agreement, that was proper. And so then how is it that the antenuptial agreement what is it in the district court's order or the actions where you claim that there was a deviation from the antenuptial agreement, except for the acceleration of the payments, other than the acceleration of the payment? That's what I'm trying to understand.
Okay, thank you for the judge, for the
sure,
question.
Sure.
And if you look at your case that you decided, that you wrote an opinion on called Timp versus Gibbs that you just did 2 years ago, You made it very clear that a court must enforce a contract, as you said, even if the result is harsh. All right. So in this particular case, and I'm trying to answer your question, you have a contract that says if this thing doesn't work out, we're going to take a multiple of the number of years. And in this case, it turned out to be $850,000. And the express intent of the parties, just like any of us would be, if we have a problem, unless you're extremely wealthy and extremely liquid, no one has $850,000 laying around to pay off an obligation. But we structure it, but they structured it in this agreement where it would be paid off in 5 years. That was the plan.
Okay, so that's part of it, but what, in what other ways? I mean, are you arguing that?
I'll give you another way, very clear.
Okay, good, thank you. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Okay, yeah. Section 4B of the anti-nuptial agreement. It talks about marital property, if they're to be sold, that they shall be divided equally. Well, when you sell property, many times there's tax consequences with that property. And the anti-nuptial agreement contemplates that the taxes would be borne by the parties equally along with the sale. And the judge did not do that. And we've had a situation now where in the 18 or 19 months that have intervened since the decree, all these properties have been liquidated by this receiver, and they're sticking Mr. Berg with all the tax consequences, which is completely contrary to the spirit of the anti-nuptial agreement.
Tax consequences for marital real estate, or tax consequences for non-marital property?
Well, the agreement.
And where do I find that, and how?
You find that in section 4B. Of the anti-nuptial.
No. I mean, in the record, I've got the anti-nuptial agreement in front of you, and I've got 4B in front of me, but yes. in the record. And then I've got another question for you about that. You know, we've got a default proceeding here. And so the only evidence, and this was a sanction that the court, you know, and we'll figure out whether the court acted properly or not. But
yes, it did not, Your Honor.
But the evidence in front of the court is what the court issued its ruling on. So if excuse me, Mr. Goldstein.
All right.
If we find that the court properly entered a sanction that this would be a default proceeding, then it seems like your argument about tax consequences falls by the wayside, because the burden would be on your client to show it, but the sanction of the court is that your client doesn't have that opportunity. Well, I mean, that's the conundrum that we're in here.
No problem for you on that, because the judge completely blew the issue of due process with respect to the hearing. And I can give you 7 or 8 reasons why. I've got 3 minutes left. I'd like to give you some of those reasons. First of all, there was absolutely no opportunity for counsel to cross-examine the witnesses. The Kemmerer case, which is cited by Mr. Knack, is from 1939, a Supreme Court case. It's been the law in this state for 82 years that even in a default hearing, they're entitled to cross-examine the witnesses. There was no opportunity to be heard by Mr. Knack. Look at the transcript, page 11. He asked to be heard. He was shut down immediately. There was a complete issue with this default judgment problem, where the default judgment exceeds the pleadings and exceeds the scope of the claim. You look at Rule 54.03 and the Alagriza case that was cited by Mr. Knack at the hearing, and which appears in our supplemental. Here's the Supreme Court of the state of Minnesota saying it is elementary in a default divorce that the court cannot exceed the pleadings. You have a huge problem with the expert. The expert report was sent over to Mr. Knack at midnight, 12:18 a.m. the night before the hearing. In complete violation of Rule 26.01 C2, which requires a 30-day notice.
Is that fact in the record someplace? In the record?
Absolutely. It's in the
where?
Record. You read the transcript. There's two transcripts. Read both transcripts. I told you in my memorandum that I submitted for the stay motion that the most, and I've looked.
They're in your letter is what you're saying, the page numbers. Your supplemental.
Yes. But okay. What's important, and I've got a minute left, but what's utterly important, and I've had to do what you've had to do. There's over 700 entries in the district court file. This is a very unusually large file. But if you read the, and Mr. Rodman would agree with me on this point, so that we're not cherry picking points, as he calls it, out of the transcript. Read both transcripts, and you will see that everything that I've told you appears there with the due process violations that we have here. And I guess I would remind the court also that Judge Riley, we haven't had a chance to talk to yet, but when you decided the case of Ertl versus Ertl back in 2015, you talk about how important procedural due process is, and it has to be fair, it has to be practical, and it has to be reasonable. And none of those things occurred here. If you read that transcript the way I did, both of them, your heads will spin to see all the violations of due process.
Thank you, Mr. Goldstein. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal time. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Scott Rodman, R-O-D-M-A-N, here on behalf of the respondent, who is the petitioner in the underlying district court file. Your Honors, today I'm going to spend some of the time that I have responding to some comments and assertions made by Mr. Goldstein in his oral argument. I'd like to be more responsive and reactive today and also address some of the questions that Judge Siegel had asked to provide some additional perspective on the same. However, as this court correctly noted at the very outset of this appeal, when it asked for informal memoranda on the issue of the scope of appellate review, that there was a potential jurisdictional issue. The parties briefed that issue for the court, and the court accepted jurisdiction based on an unpublished case, which demonstrated that the procedural errors, as noted by the district court when it denied the appellant's motion for amended findings or in the alternative a new trial, was not fatal to proceeding with an appeal that addresses the sufficiency of the evidence. And the court also noted in its order that this is not an expression of opinion as to whether or not the appellant has actually preserved any issues for appeal. So correctly, the first question for this panel to decide is, what is the appropriate scope of appellate review? What did the appellant properly preserve in by way of issues for this court's consideration? And the respondent would submit that the appellant did not preserve any issues for appellate review. Certainly, not any questions.
Mr. Rodman, I mean, isn't sufficiency of the evidence preserved?
Let me clarify.
And you don't always, you know, and I know we've got two timing issues here. There's the notice for amended findings and a new trial, and then the notice of appeal. But sufficiency of the evidence, would that encompass? Well, why don't you respond to that and then answer whether that would encompass deviations from the antenuptial agreement? I mean, it would seem to me, but.
I would be happy to address that, Your Honor. The scope of the court's review on sufficiency of the evidence is limited to whether or not the evidence produced at trial was sufficient for the fact finder to make the findings of fact that it did and draw the same conclusions of law. Was the evidence sufficient to support the findings and conclusions reached by the court. And the Court of Appeals must view this in light of the reality that this proceeded by default proceeding. So the only evidence that was submitted as a result of the discovery sanction that couldn't have been more justified and well supported by the district court, that the decision to proceed by default, did the evidence submitted somehow fail to support the findings that the court actually reached? Sufficiency of the evidence does not relate to questions of law for the appellate court's review, nor does it question procedural or discovery issues that the court may have made during the course of the proceeding. The reality in this matter, Your Honors, is that the appellant failed to preserve any issues other than, as this court has ruled, the sufficiency of the evidence, because the court—
So is it your argument that we're deprived of jurisdiction over if we feel that there is an error of law?
I don't believe those, yes, Your Honor, I don't believe that those have been properly preserved for appeal. A question
based
of law
on, was not related to sufficiency of the evidence. Do you have authority? I mean, what authority are you relying on for that?
Your Honor, I don't have specific authority to cite right now. What I would state is that a review of the cases that address sufficiency of the evidence and that have been included in the briefing before this court. Note that it always entails a review of the actual evidence received and whether or not the district court either abused their discretion or if it was a clear error to make a finding based on that evidence. So if someone testified that I own house A and the court said I'm awarding you house B, the questions of law relating to whether or not the antenuptial agreement was, quote, invalidated, which we assert it was not, as the appellant continues to conflate enforcement with an invalidation of the antenuptial agreement, or whether or not the district court erred in imposing a discovery sanction of default or appointing a receiver or awarding conduct-based fees or any of the other arguments, all of the case law, even cited by the appellant, demonstrates the Court of Appeals conducting a review on appeal that goes well beyond the sufficiency of the evidence. Those were different cases where those appellants had brought a timely motion for a new trial that stated with specificity the relief that was being sought by the moving party, that attached an affidavit identifying the grounds for relief, all the things that did not occur in this case.
And so that we're clear,
district court, yes, Your Honor.
You asserted this as a jurisdictional restriction. That's not we're not talking about a jurisdictional question. Our court has jurisdiction over any of the issues. It's just a matter of the scope of the review.
That's absolutely, that's correct, Your Honor. When I referred to a jurisdictional argument, I was referring to the question that the court posed and requested informal memoranda on whether or not, in fact, this court had jurisdiction or, in fact, the notice of appeal was untimely. The court did find that it could accept jurisdiction based on an unpublished case that related to the sufficiency of the
evidence. Right. And as I understand it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, you mentioned that you don't have case support for it, but the idea that, I mean, I understand the argument, seems consistent with the authority I'm familiar with, that you're not going to be able to raise questions of impropriety
procedure.
You don't have a sufficient preservation of the issues. But as far as legal questions go, I'm not aware of case law that supports the proposition that we can't address legal errors that would allegedly have or potentially have infected the court's ultimate conclusion of law. Are you aware of any support for the proposition that we can't address legal questions?
Only, Your Honor, that I have not been able to find a single case where that's in fact what a court was doing when it identified a limited scope of review on sufficiency of the evidence.
Well, have you found a case that addresses the issue of the whether this court can, in addition to the procedural challenges on appeal, this court is restricted in any way from considering the legal issues that bear on the district court's ultimate legal conclusions?
No, only that I haven't seen it done. But even in light of the court's consideration that it may have jurisdiction to address alleged errors of law, I'm certainly relieved, given that there were no errors of law committed by the district court judge. This couldn't be a more clear case where a district court judge gave opportunity after opportunity, bent over backwards to accommodate ongoing willful obstruction and noncompliance from the appellant, putting him on explicit notice of what those consequences would be. The district court judge was obviously aware that this matter would proceed on appeal and was very careful in all of the orders that issued prior to the default hearings in laying the foundation for the action that she took, which is well supported not only as a discovery sanction under Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 37, but also well supported by all applicable case law, given that there was no other option or recourse left to the district court judge but to proceed by default, as she found that the appellant's failure to produce relevant and necessary discovery or to comply with a myriad of discovery-related receiver and special master directives had impossibly prejudiced the petitioner from being able to present her case at trial because she had been deprived of the very information that was exclusively within the control of the appellant.
Mr. Rodman, I have a question about your cross appeal or related appeal. And you say that the district court made 14 clerical errors. And I have roughly grouped them into two categories. And I'm curious if you agree with how I've grouped them. The first one is that the district court erred because you presume that the district court intended to accept all of your experts' conclusions. And the second grouping would be that the errors were based on arithmetical errors or typos. Would you agree that that's, I'll say, gross characterization of your two categories of alleged errors?
Your Honor, I think that is a fair approximation of the arguments that are being made. The majority of the noted clerical errors are of the clear and obvious omission, where a finding of fact was made as to an asset or as to the marital or non-marital nature, but no corresponding or a contradicting conclusion of law issued, a mathematical error where assets and liabilities were added together instead of subtracting therefrom, completely omitted assets that were not awarded, such as petroleum services, the complete omission of the value of the party's personal property when there were specific findings supporting the valuation that was intended to be included. So the majority of those clerical errors are pretty clear and obvious on their face that this court can simply on the face of the judgment and decree clearly identify what the intent was of the district court judge and can and should order that those amendments be made or that it be remanded back to the district court for further proceedings consistent with the direction of this court.
So can I?
I'm
sorry. If I can ask another question along those lines, in term like setting aside just the arithmetic errors right now. And looking at the ones, well, it was in the expert's testimony and report, but it didn't show up in the findings and conclusions. The district court judge is still, even in a default proceeding, is still bound by the dissolution statute and to come up with a fair and equitable distribution of property. And right. So why shouldn't we assume, and this is just clerical error now, because I mean, the motion for amended findings was untimely. So how can we read into the judge's mind, who's now retired, in fact, that in fact, the judge intended something different? I mean, that I've particularly when you're talking about over $1 million, calling that a clerical error. Tell me how we get around that.
Well, Your Honor, again, I think that the court right now is focusing on one, perhaps two of the much larger number of clerical errors. The ones that the court is specifically focusing on, the argument is that when viewed as in its totality, both all of the language in the judgment and decree and the language of the transcript of the trial, that it would be reasonable for the court to conclude that the district court had intended to identify marital versus non-marital nature of the certain assets that were identified. But again, the overwhelming majority of these clerical errors are clear on the face of the document. In other words, the findings of fact must be reconciled with the conclusions of law. And that goes both to omitted assets. For example, on personal property, the court went into great detail identifying the basis for the valuation. Even as this court noted, the district court judge went out of her way to demonstrate that she was going to be active and engaged in the default proceeding. She asked questions herself. She even requested supplemental documentation from the respondent to further verify assertions that were made. And she did so, as is reflected in the transcript, to demonstrate that it was her job to ensure that an equitable result issued from this, and that the distribution between the parties was fair and equitable despite the default. And I think she endeavored to do so. So while one or two of those are subject to perhaps more judicial discretion, the overwhelming majority of them, and not an insignificant number, should be clear simply on the face of the judgment and decree itself. I do see that I'm out of time.
You are out of time, but I'll take the liberty to press you with one specific question as to, assume it's a matter of law. Assume we deem it appropriate for us to consider, and assume it's a matter of law, the question of the acceleration of the payments to your client, whether or not that's consistent or inconsistent with the antenuptial agreement. What's your best argument to justify, as consistent with the antenuptial agreement, the acceleration?
I am so glad that you asked that question, Your Honor, and that I get an opportunity to respond. The case law cited by the appellant's counsel and argued today by appellant's new counsel relates to contract law and interpretation. An antenuptial agreement is undoubtedly a contract. However, there is different case law that applies in the context of an antenuptial agreement. The case law, in fact, I think it's misleading in the argument, in the brief, in appellant's brief, where it says that any modification of an antenuptial agreement is on its own contrary to law on its face. That ignores all of the well-settled case law involving antenuptial agreements. The seminal, or at least oft-cited one, is McKee-Johnson versus Johnson. I can give a cite if the court is interested. It's 444 Northwest 2nd 259. The district court still needs to determine that not only is an antenuptial agreement both procedurally fair and substantively fair at the time of execution, but it must further find that it is substantively fair at the time of enforcement. That's why when appellant's counsel refers to the language itself of the judgment and decree, he cited provision 13B, that the provisions of this agreement shall not be subject to subsequent modification by any court except by mutual consent in writing of the parties. Your Honors, I'm very familiar and experienced with antenuptial law. I wrote the chapter in the Minnesota CLE's desk book on it. We always include language like that in antenuptial agreements. We who practice in antenuptial law know that it's simply not enforceable. It's intended to give the parties of an idea that the antenuptial agreement should not be modified. But the argument that an antenuptial agreement is somehow inviolable by the district court simply is contrary to well-settled case law that a court can invalidate, strike, or otherwise modify provisions of an antenuptial agreement at the time of enforcement if doing so is necessary to ensure that the outcome is fair and equitable. And in fact, that's the reason why the antenuptial agreement contains provision 7, severability. To the extent any provision of this agreement shall be invalid or unenforceable, it shall be considered deleted herefrom, and the remainder of the provisions of this agreement shall be unaffected and continue in full force and effect. That's the same kind of boilerplate we include for this very situation where a court recognizes, and the case of McKee Johnson v. Johnson states that some courts have been able to relieve parties from contract provisions which even though procedurally and substantively fair at the inception, have become unconscionably unfair by the time of enforcement as a result of circumstances originally not foreseen by the contracting parties. This district court judge recognized that a monthly payment would result in nothing but enforcement proceedings and determined that that the appellant had the ability to pay that as in one lump sum as part of the property equalizer, and that would avoid the problem of ongoing enforcement proceedings on a monthly payment. Right.
Okay, thank you. Counsel for appellant, I asked a question that took the respondent 5 minutes additionally over the time. I'm going to make sure that you have an additional 5 minutes, so you'll have 10 minutes of rebuttal time rather than 5 minutes of rebuttal time if you'd like to use it, and you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. That's only fair. I have several points that I'd like to make during this brief rebuttal. The first one goes to the issue of whether or not there should have been a default hearing in the first place. There's much that I could say about that, but this is not a situation where we have a party that simply stuck his head in the sand and did nothing. As the record indicates, thousands and thousands of pages of responses were made during the discovery process. And you don't need to take my word for it, Your Honors. I invite you to look at the opinion and the report from Special Master Kathleen Guerin, where she dealt specifically with some of Mr. Rodman's discovery requests. These are her words, not my words. She found the requests to be repetitive. She found them to be not likely to result in relevant information. And then she went on. She didn't talk about the request being inconvenient. She didn't talk about them being questionable, maybe difficult to gather. Her words were that his requests were unduly burdensome. So you have a situation, and he's shaking his head. That's exactly what she said in the order. And you have a district court judge.
Just let me pause you for a minute, and you can stop the clock, Marshall, for just a moment. Mr. Rodman, if we were in court, I would admonish you or anyone who's on your side not to make gestures during your opponent's argument. It is a bit distracting. We can assume for the record that you disagree with Mr. Goldstein's argument, just as we assume that he disagrees with yours, and there's it doesn't help for the gesturing. And
I understand, and I apologize. And of course, the record speaks amply for itself in this matter.
And again, I wasn't offering that as an opportunity for you to add argument, but just to caution you to use proper decorum, even though this is a video proceeding rather than live. Mr. Goldstein, you may proceed.
So don't rely on me and don't rely on Mr. Rodman. Read Judge Guerin's report. That's exactly what she said. And you have a situation where these parties were had contentious litigation, thousands and thousands of pages, 20 years of tax returns, personal and business. financial statements, business records, accounts receivable journals, passwords to credit card information and bank records were all produced. And the lawyers were battling each other over scope, over nature of the requests and the various objections. And you have a judge in the district court judge who decided this case on New Year's Eve, December 31st, 2019. She retired 7 days later. And, you know, I don't know what was in her mind, but she wanted to hear this case. And evidently she had it in for my client. And she made the decision that I think was improper to conduct a default hearing because of the lack of discovery. And again, I invite you to look at the record and the report of the special master. That's number one. Number two, and I've heard it today and I've seen it in the transcript. Don't take my word for it. Read the transcript. We have the same problem today. We're dealing with the question of the sufficiency of the evidence. And at the default hearing, when the judge pressed Mr. Rodman to go forward with this, look at the transcript, page 2, page 7, page 8, page 9. He says over and over and over again that he is not prepared to proceed. And if you want to limit the scope of review here, which you shouldn't do, but if you want to limit it just to the sufficiency of the evidence, it's clearly right there in the record that the evidence can't possibly be sufficient because counsel was not prepared and they could not even put on the case. And he's in his own words, they're not my words. On page 9 of the transcript, Mr. Rodman tells the district court judge that it would be unethical to proceed with the default hearing under the circumstances that the judge was ordering. Not my words, read the transcript, page 9. We have the same problem today though. He wasn't prepared then, and he's not prepared today to try to give you case law on why the scope of review should be limited. And he's wrong. There is case law, Supreme Court case law, two times. You have the Madsen case, which was cited in your information below, which tells exactly what the situation is. All you've got to do is make a timely motion, and you've got to have a proper paperwork to go along with it with a justifiable reason. And that's the law of the case of Madsen. And as I've told you today, the case law from Alpha, which again is a Supreme Court case, says that the interpretation of this contract is de novo. It is without deference to the trial court, and we're entitled to a de novo look here.
Mr. Goldstein?
Yes.
In the brief, you keep referring to a tax-free sum. And I'm trying to understand what you mean by that, because I'm sure you would agree with me that neither the parties nor this court can make a binding decision about what's taxable or not. And so I'm just trying to understand what that's a reference to.
That's a great question, Judge, and thank you for that. And the issue is the allocation, not of just assets, but of liabilities and tax consequences that go with it. And the antinuptial agreement contemplates that if, in the section that I quoted to you, that if marital property is sold, that that it's to be equally divided. Well, if there was a mortgage that was owing, we would all agree that the mortgage would be taken care of out of that equally. And the same thing with the tax liability. All these properties that have been liquidated by the receiver in the 19 months that have passed on since the decree was entered. The district court judge has assigned all those tax consequences to Mr. Berg, and we're talking about large sums of money. The other thing about the deviation issue that Chief Judge Siegel asked me about earlier, the basis for the judge to deviate was based on her supposition somehow that Mr. Berg would never make the payments to Ms. Berg. And in fact, and indeed, the very first payment that was required by the antinuptial agreement was paid. So there's absolutely zero foundation, zero evidence, zero rationale for the trial judge to have deviated in that regard.
But Mr. Goldstein, your client did fail to follow the court's orders on making payments for marital property. I mean, that seems uncontroverted in the record.
That I would disagree with. And that. Tell me what he was supposed to do that he didn't do.
I think mortgage payments, among other things.
All of that is
and the
you look at the offer of proof that was submitted by Mr. Knack. He goes through in detail the dispute on that. Again, you have a trial based
and then
on
if
no
we
cross-examination.
Find, okay, I'm just trying to save you time here. So if we say we agree with you, yes, that the acceleration, the court acted beyond its authority, you know, the district court may well keep a receiver in place to make those payments over the next 5 years. Is that, I mean, which option would your client prefer, I guess, if that's the result?
The case needs to be remanded back down. They need to have a trial. Due process needs to be followed. Expert witnesses need to be properly disclosed, come in and testify as to valuations, everything else that goes on in a trial. This, I hate to say it, the trial judge in 2011, 2012, as I recall, spent time overseas trying war criminals in Kosovo. I'm telling you, my client is not a war criminal, and this isn't Kosovo. But this was treated in district court. His due process rights were completely ignored. And the only way this can be undone is to send this back and have a trial on the merits. Are there other questions? We've got 1 minute left, or I'll sum up.
Looks like there are no questions. Feel free to take the last minute to summarize.
The last thing I want you to understand is that this decree created this vicious circle by deviating from the anti-nuptial agreement and imposing a judgment in excess of $1 million. That set into stage collection efforts that were made by Mr. Rodman on behalf of his client, which he had every right to do under the decree. His collection efforts met with objections on the part of Mr. Berg, and that resulted in numerous contempt hearings. He was put into jail for not signing a deed. I can't believe that would happen in America. And that has led to $1 million worth of receiver's fees and I think $150,000 or more in conduct-based attorney's fees. This is so out of whack, it needs to be sent back down for a remand. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Well, thank you, Mr. Goldstein, and thank you, Mr. Rodman, for your arguments, your briefing, a very thorough briefing, and for your oral argument today. And thank you for indulging the court and participating with us for a few extra minutes on both sides so we could clarify some things. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you both, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you. Everyone have a good rest of your day.